Thanks, Bryce. I appreciate it. I'm so happy to get to know you through our Doctor of Ministry program, and it's just cool with video conferencing and things, people from all over the country can do graduate work. You don't have to move to Memphis, and so we have people in places like Little Rock doing that. I'm so happy to be here. I got this feeling. I drove in this morning, and I've never lived on Little Rock, and I haven't spent a ton of time here, but I did go to college down the road at Harding. And so I did feel this little bit of sweet feeling as I pulled into Little Rock today and thought back to our days here. I was only visited Little Rock as a Harding student, so my experience on Little Rock is that I know where every single movie theater is, and I've never been to any of the good restaurants. And so that's basically all I've got. It's good to see some of you who are Memphis people. I saw Daniel Wade here. Avery, are you here? Hey, Avery. So anyway, great to any of the rest of you who are from Memphis, it's good to see you whenever you lived there. I wanted to talk today about something that's a word we don't use very much. And it's a word that probably is not in your regular vocabulary. It's a word you might feel uneasy if somebody said it about you. And interestingly, we don't even use it very much in church, which is weird because it is the absolute positive churchiest word that I can ever think of. And that's the word saint. If somebody said to you, "I hear you're a saint," you'd get a little uneasy. Even if they meant it as an absolute compliment, you might be a little uneasy with that. Or if they said, "Hey, I bet your church is full of a bunch of saints," that might be a little uncomfortable. And it's okay. We sometimes feel uncomfortable, but it's kind of does get awkward when we read the New Testament. And that is like one of the number one ways that the people of God are described as being the saints. You know, like if you make a list and like, okay, how many times do people get called Christians and how many times they get called saints wins every time. That people of God are called the saints. And so I kind of want to wrestle with why that's awkward for us and what that might mean. Some of you might be familiar with an application you can use online called Google Ngram, N-G-R-A-M. If you go into your Google bar and you just type in Ngram, you can go to this utility that as a librarian, I would think that this is amazing fun. I don't know if you'll think this is fun. But some of you might know that Google has taken it on themselves to basically scan every book that's been published over the last 200 years into their database. And so they basically know every word that's been used in English literature over the past 200 years and how many times it's been used. The system knows this. So there's this interesting utility. You can put it up here on the screen that we're going to see where you can type in a word into Google Ngram, and it'll show you the frequency of this word over time. Beginning in 1800 on the left-hand side, that's the frequency of the use of the word saint. And then you can see up until the present moment, 2018, that it has a story that looks a lot like a bad day for the stock market. And so this is kind of the life of the word saint. I would encourage you, if you ever want to have fun with any words that you suspect are getting more popular or less popular, if you really have a few hours to lose and be a geek, Google Ngram might be for you. But it does show us something about this word, which is to say the church is not alone in being a little uncomfortable with using the word saint. What do you think of when you hear the word saint? You might think of old expression of righteousness. You might think of Catholicism, or think about people who have been honored as saints at the Vatican. You might think of songs like When the Saints Go Marching In, or a football team that plays in New Orleans, but you might not think of you. I don't really ever think of myself as a saint. And when I was younger, I can promise you, my parents never thought of me that way either. But God does. If you are in Christ, God believes you are a saint. In the New Testament, Paul definitely believes you're a saint. We're going to turn over in the Bible a little bit today, and I'm going to show you some texts that I think kind of reinforce this point and help us to get a kind of a working definition of what it is to be a saint. I'm going to begin in the book of Romans. In Romans, if you have a Bible, you can pull it out. But in the Romans, it begins the book and ends the book by discussing this idea. He begins it in verse 7 of the entire book, 1 and 7. It says, to all who are in Rome, who are loved by God and called to be saints. All this word means here, he's kind of almost using a word that wasn't used very much. He uses the word holy ones. We use the word saints in English, but Paul just takes the word for holy, applies it to a group of people, and you get holy ones. You say, well, yeah, that's obvious, right? I mean, that's not a big deal. He called people holy. But it is a big deal. It seems at this point in time, when Paul is saying this, that the word holy is almost never used in the religious world of Paul, which is a very religious world. Everybody had idols. There was all kinds of faiths and religions and sacred sites. People went on pilgrimages to go to sacred places. The word holy is almost never applied to people. It's used for places. That's a holy place or a holy God. Even think about the Old Testament. Moses, take off your shoes. Why? The place you're standing is holy. In the book of Isaiah, holy, holy, holy is, well, the Lord. And Paul says, holy ones, people. When he ends the book, if you go to chapter 16, he picks up there and he says in verse 15 of chapter 16, greet Philologus, Julia, Nereus, and his sister, and Olympus, and all the saints with them. Again, a group of people. He says, if you're in this body, you're the holy ones. Okay, one book. Does he do it again? Corinthians, 1 Corinthians 1 and 2. As he begins, to the church of God in Corinth, to those sanctified in Christ Jesus and called to be holy together with all those everywhere who call in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, their Lord and ours. That those who are called to be holy, those sanctified, your translation might have the word saints. Now think about this. Our original definition, we said, well, saints are those really great people. Now, if you know anything about the book of 1 Corinthians, we know that this church is really struggling. They have some serious issues. Like, they have every issue you could think of. I mean, they're the Kardashians in togas, okay? And Paul opens the letter and says, saints. And so already we're like, okay, doesn't mean you're morally blameless. And the way he uses it in Romans, you're like, okay, you don't exactly have to be like the official leader of the church, right? Because he called an ordinary group of people. So it wasn't like every church had one saint or two saints or a committee of saints. So far, what do we know? Well, it's the people of the body. It's not about being morally blameless. Later in 2 Corinthians, he's going to go and use it again. Same thing. He's going to call a group of people. And so even there, we can make a determination that he's not just saying the way we would use it, St. Paul, St. John, St. Peter. In fact, I can't find a place in the New Testament where Paul refers to the individual as being a saint, although he refers to the group of individuals as saints. So it's not as if he's distinguishing one person from the rest by saying, well, they're a saint and you're not. He's calling the group. You know, in some traditions, this is proven difficult. You might remember Mother Teresa of Calcutta died a few years ago. And though she was recognized as the number one most prominent humanitarian in the Christian faith over the 20th century, when she died, she had still not been approved to be a saint. And so, this is a true story, she actually had to submit an application for sainthood. Can you imagine being on the board of review to receive Mother Teresa's application to determine if she was a saint? Who feels up to that task? Like, she just didn't measure up to the criteria of what I thought a good person would look like. But anyway, she And you're like, if Mother Teresa can't cut it, what hope do the rest of us have, right? And that, but there's this idea like, well, it's honorific. But what Paul is saying is, no, it's not honorific. It's not meritorious. It is based on being in Christ. That being a saint is something that about what God is conferring through you, to you. Being a saint isn't about what you are offering to the Lord. It's what the Lord is offering the world through you. And that's what it means to be the holy ground in the world, to be the sacred space in our communities. Are we willing yet to use the word saint? Let's kind of walk through our list, see if maybe we feel a little more comfortable. Group of people, not just individuals. Not based on being blameless. He never would have said it to Corinth if it was. Not worth based on some sort of merit system. Certainly wouldn't have said it to these churches if that were the case. But instead, being a saint is saying, being the community of saints is saying something very specific. If we take how it's used in the Old Testament and move it here, this is the space in the world where you can most clearly see the work of God. Take off your shoes. The place where you're standing is holy. The Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth keep silence before him. I feel comfortable saying that. I feel comfortable saying that there is a sense of where the presence of God is in the world, that I want to affirm that as being the place I want to be. It's the place I need to be quiet. It's the place I want to take my shoes off and say, this is where I think the work of God is. I feel like we have saints in our lives. I have a 9-year-old and a 3-year-old, both girls. They're the best. And our 3-year-old has a special relationship with a man in our congregation who I've never asked him what age he is, but he's over 70. And he doesn't exactly have a dynamism around kids that would expect you to draw them. He doesn't necessarily go, he's not really very over the top or whatever that you would think a 3-year-old. Anyway, it's her best friend at church. And in fact, we were on vacation recently. We were at the beach, we're in the water, and I'm playing with my daughter in the beach, and I held her up, and she said, Dad, this is so much fun. And I said, yep, and who's your favorite? And she named this man, who's back in Memphis, Tennessee. She names this guy. And every weekend, we go through the routine where it's like, it's Friday, what are we doing this weekend? Well, it's Saturday, and then we're going to go to church. And then when we go to church, we're going to see Mr. Dave. Yes, we're going to see Mr. Dave. And so that's why we go to church, is to see him. And I think, like, I wouldn't trade that for anything. I wouldn't trade that for anything. And I'm serious. Like, I know this would be really weird, but, like, next time I see him and we're around him and I'm watching my daughter learn faith from him, I just want to, like, take my shoes off. Now, that would embarrass our daughter, so I'm not going to do it. But isn't that how you feel? If there's these moments where you feel like God is uniquely working in your life or you're seeing it in the life of others, don't you just kind of be like, I just want to be quiet and take my shoes off? That's what it means to live among the saints. We had an interesting situation. Last weekend, I went to a funeral for the smartest man I've ever known. His name is Jack P. Lewis, Dr. Jack P. Lewis, major scholar in Churches of Christ, earned 2 doctorates, 2 PhDs in biblical studies, and established himself as world-renowned. That is not why I was necessarily impressed at his funeral. I knew that story. But he died at the age of 99, and while sitting in his funeral, one of the ministers who was part of his church during the 90s shared some stories about him that were so impressive. And worthy, I think, of thinking of him as being somebody who made the church feel like sacred space. This is a person who worked his entire life on a salary of a Christian college professor. And yet the minister of the church this man was at during the 90s, and this would have been a church of 700 or 800 people in Memphis, the minister said that this Christian college professor during that time gave more money to the church than all of their professional class people during that time, because he lived so frugally, spent so little, and gave everything. And my wife and I, that was the thing that connected with this. We said, this guy's brilliant, but the generosity, it just kind of made you want to take your shoes off. In fact, it didn't really make you feel that way. We were driving away, and I honestly looked at my wife, and I was like, that was one of those funerals you sit at where you feel like you've done nothing. What am I doing with my life? And so you feel like, wow. I mean, kind of inspired, but also kind of ashamed. Like, wow, we're like approaching halfway through this thing. I need to get on it. So I wanted to make myself feel better. So we went and decided to do something we do about once a year. We went and saw a movie. And we saw Won't You Be My Neighbor, the story of Mr. Rogers. How many of you have seen this movie? I thought it was popular. Okay. Spoiler alert, a lot of kids loved this guy, and he was a huge deal for a long time. Clever song. And you're watching this, and I'm watching this. I thought this was going to be the thing that made me feel good, and I'm watching the way this guy interacts with children, and I'm like, oh, that's amazing. This is why I watched as a kid. This is why our girls would watch this. I want to be like that. I want to be around people like that. It kind of makes you want to take your shoes off. Those stories that we see are when we appreciate that the church has that kind of capacity in our lives and in the life of the world. Not that these people are perfect. Not that every single person in a church has their life together in the same way. Not that everybody even has their life together. But there's these glimpses that you get where you can see the goodness of God through people. And there's only one thing that can really hold that back for us. And the one thing is that sometimes we view ourselves and we view others through our liabilities and not through the work that God is doing in us. And you know you do it. There's times that you look in the mirror in the morning and you don't think you're looking at a saint. And sometimes when we view ourselves, we think of ourselves as those two or three things we're struggling with and not the four or five ways that God is working through us. And we look at other people this way too, don't we? You can have a great time with a person and people said, how did it go? And you tell them the one negative thing that happened. And we do that. We're treating our sainthood like it's about that moral perfection and about that meritorious stuff and not saying, no. It's that by hanging out here, people can appreciate the holiness and the goodness and the righteousness of the Lord. I don't know, there's a movie that came out a few years ago that really impressed me. Any of you seen the movie Saint Vincent? Same people who saw Mr. Rogers. Okay. Excellent movie. Features Bill Murray and Melissa McCarthy and that other person. Anyway, it's the story of Melissa McCarthy plays a mom, a single mom, and with a young son. And they move to a new place, and she gets a job. She's a nurse, and she's trying to get her life settled and establish this life together with her young son. As she gets more hours and gets some shift changes at work, she runs into a problem. Her son is enrolled in Catholic school, and she needs a place to put him. When she's not at home, he's pretty young to be home by himself, and she's trying to figure out where she can keep her son. Well, she kind of looks around for people she knows, and she's brand new to the community. And the only person she's met so far is this really crusty guy who lives next door to them named Vince, played by Bill Murray. Vince has every single bad habit that you know of. He has every edge of crustiness that you might not want to put your 11-year-old with. And yet, Vince has even hangs out with people you may not want your people hanging out with people who hang out with those people. And so Vince causes some anxiety with her, but there is one thing about Vince that makes him perfect to ask to do this, which is that Vince is available because Vince basically spends his life sitting on lawn chairs and hanging out. And so Vince reluctantly accepts the task of hanging out with the boy for a few hours a day before mom gets home from her shift. This is him doing yard work. So Vince and the boy develop a relationship, some of it at the horse track, and Vince begins to rub off in every way. Vince reluctantly receives this. She reluctantly participates in it. And the boy seems to be kind of getting along at this time in his life, but we don't know exactly what's going through his head. He's busy in school, and he's assigned at his Catholic school with doing a project where he looks back at church history or his experience there in Sheepshead Bay, New York, to identify and study the saints, people like Thomas Aquinas or Augustine or Irenaeus or Mother Teresa or these people that you would want to study. And so he has this task of doing this. We're assuming at this point he's not doing homework because he's playing at the racetrack. His presentation is going to come up and a large school program will happen, and the boy invites everybody he knows to come to this special program where he makes a presentation on a saint that he has studied.
Born in 1946 in Sheepshead Bay, the son of first-generation Irish immigrants. Growing up poor on the streets of Brooklyn, Vincent learned all the things a kid shouldn't need to know: fighting, cursing, and gambling. In 1965, as a member of United States Army 5th Regiment, Vincent was among the 450 soldiers dropped into the La Drang Valley and immediately ambushed by 2,000 enemy troops. There, he heroically saved the lives of two wounded officers pinned down by enemy fire and carried them to safety. He was awarded the Bronze Star for his bravery. I imagine the best way I can tell you who Mr. Vincent McKenna is to tell you what he's done for me. When me and my mom first moved here, we knew no one, and Mr. McKenna took me in. When he didn't have to, and most likely didn't want to, but he did it anyhow, because that's what saints do. We visited his wife, Sandy, of 40 years, who recently passed away. Vince done her laundry every week for the past 8 years, long after she no longer recognized him. The saints never give up. He taught me how to fight, how to stand my ground and be brave, how to speak up and be bold, because saints fight for themselves and others so that they might be heard. He taught me how to gamble, horse racing, keno, the over and under, which is a big reason why I'm grounded till I'm 18. But in that, I learned how to take risks and go for broke, because in life, the odds can be stacked against you. This is Vin's cat, Felix, who eats gourmet cat food while Vin eats sardines. The saints make sacrifices. Yes, Mr. Vincent McKenna is flawed, seriously flawed, but just like all the other saints we studied. Because after all, saints are human beings, very human beings. Courage, sacrifice, compassion, humanity, these are the markings of a saint, and what makes Mr. Vincent McKenna not so far removed from St. William of Rochester. And with that, I'd like to present my friend and babysitter, Mr. Vincent McKenna, for sainthood, and hereby proclaim him St. Vincent of Sheepshead Bay.
When you look in the mirror, you may not see a saint, but are you willing to believe that the work of God through you will be in light of his work and not your liabilities? God may not be calling everyone to be a Peter and John, but he can often use an Andrew. God needs Rahab to hide the spies just as much as he needs David to slay the giant. Can you have the hospitality of Zacchaeus? Can you bring peace like Barnabas, tell the truth like Nathan, or show loyalty like Ruth? You may struggle today with overeating. You may wrestle with time management. You may fight depression, and you might feel a deep sense of loneliness, but I want to tell you that those things do not define you, and they do not make this group any less saintly. I know it's easy to focus on those things that make you look in the mirror and not see a saint. And you may look at your Instagram feed and see that other people look more beautiful at the moment or seem to be having more fun at the time. But are we willing to put trust in the work that God is doing as a group? Are we willing to put trust that through the work of the Spirit and not through our own perfection, our own sense of merit, that God is doing a powerful thing that in the end, though imperfect, might just make us want to take our shoes off? The invitation of God is to believe this, that though you may not look in the mirror and see a saint, that you, when you look in the church, you see a sainthood. Are you willing today to be called a saint? God is calling on his church to be saints and to stop being spectators. Paul says, therefore I urge you, in view of God's mercy, offer your bodies as living sacrifices, holy and acceptable to God. This is your spiritual act of worship. So don't any longer be conformed to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Then you will know God's will, his good, pleasing, and perfect will. And when we do that, we're the saints. And that is what God is calling us to today. I hope you believe it.